Blog Talk Radio.
Christmas Eve, This is John Gresham from the Right Stream Network, your host today on Military Monday. Well, I want to thank everybody who's helped us build this show this year since we inaugurated it back in March and has helped us grow it and make it one of the more diverse military-oriented talk shows on the air. And today we're going to have the first of two end-of-the-year shows that I hope will be just good, clean fun. And when we talk about being a military historian, when we talk about good, clean fun, the minds of historians turn to good things, like World War II German jets. Now, before you think, say, what? Actually, the subject of advanced German fighter aircraft and so-called wonder weapons at the end of World War II is an absolutely fascinating portal at a time which was on the cusp of technology. On the one hand, it was a last desperate gasp by the Third Reich to go ahead and get back in the war by going and fielding highly capable, high-quality, very, very dangerous airplanes, specifically designed in many cases to go after Allied bombers coming in to go and bomb German industry and cities. On the other hand, these aircraft pointed the way to the future and influenced so many post-war aircraft designs, it's difficult to go ahead and explain it to everybody. But to try and do that today, we've invited an old friend of the show and an old friend of mine, Mr. Robert Dorr. We call him Bob. And Bob has just published a new book called Fighting Hitler's Jets. And we are going to go and spend the whole hour today talking to him about his book and about the subject of fighting jet and rocket airplanes in World War II. Hello, Bob. Are you there?
Hello, John. It's nice to talk with you.
Well, it's good to have you here, Bob. And I really want to start and just start out and ask you where was your interest in the German jet and rocket aircraft programs when you made the decision to do this book?
Well, since you said we're going to have good, clean fun today, I should make it clear that my new book, Fighting Hitler's Jets, came about as a result of a kind of an accidental process in which the book editors and I were talking about what to do next, and we were talking about what people are interested in and what they want to read. And we discussed a variety of topics. We discussed Area 51, the supposed secret government base at Groom Lake in Nevada. We discussed Adolf Hitler and his role in World War II. We discussed some rumors about mysterious Nazi doings during the war, such as rumors that they had established a secret base in Antarctica. And we also tried to figure out how to get vampires and zombies and Duck Dynasty into this book. But we weren't able to combine all those things. And we thought what would interest people the most would be what interests me the most. And that's aircraft and how they were designed and developed and how they were used to fight and how the German jets were developed and how the Americans fought them. So that's why it's called Fighting Hitler's Jets. And we have something happening right now that I could not have predicted when we scheduled this appearance. My dog is acting rather odd. I should say, by the way, that my dog devoured my book, Fighting Hitler's Jets. She didn't read it. She ate it.
I hope she did that with a printed copy and not with the draft.
Yes, and not with the e-book version either, fortunately.
Well, that would mean a computer or an iPad died. By the way, who is your publisher on this book, by the way?
Fighting Hitler's Jets is published by Zenith Press.
And
they are located in Minneapolis, and they are an imprint of a larger company called Keyside, and that's Q-U-A-Y, Keyside.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and get started, and for purposes of going and referencing to your book opens, of all things, at an air show in Germany. Talk a little bit about that air show and how that sort of begins the story of the German jet rocket aircraft.
Well, I call it an air show, and we can call it an air show. I suppose it might more properly be called a weapons display, but in any event, it was certainly the largest military open house that was ever held for an audience of one, and that one was Adolf Hitler, and the date was November 26, 1943. Oh, I'm so sorry about this distraction in the background. I'm totally lost as to what to do about it. Can you bear with me here while we discuss German technology and I put my dog in her crate? Come here.
Of course.
November 26, 1943, at Insterburg in Bavaria, the German hierarchy held a weapons display for the personal benefit of the Führer, of Adolf Hitler. And on display that day were all of the marvelous things that the Germans had developed up to that time. The primary focus, of course, is on the Messerschmitt 262 jet fighter, the twin-engined tricycle-gear jet fighter that was designed and built with the expectation, as you pointed out earlier, that it would be able to attack and defeat Allied bomber formations that were operating over the Third Reich. Also on display at Insterburg during this weapons exhibit for Hitler were the Messerschmitt 163 Comet, the rocket-propelled fighter, the Arado 234 twin-engine jet bomber, a number of various kinds of radar and electronic weaponry and wizardry, and even the Dornier 335 fighter, which was a propeller-driven pusher-puller fighter with propellers in front and back.
Now, it goes without saying that this was at a time when prop aircraft design was at a very advanced state. I mean, just 5 years earlier, it had astounded the world that Germany, Great Britain were fielding fighter aircraft like the Spitfire and the Messerschmitt 109, which could go 300 miles an hour in level flight. Now we're talking about a demonstration of aircraft with speeds approaching the speed of sound, almost 600 miles an hour, a roughly
double. Yes, that's right.
And it's worth asking, how in the world do you go from piston engines from great companies like Daimler-Benz and Rolls-Royce to a completely new technology like jets and rockets to go ahead and propel aircraft? Talk a little bit about the day and what Hitler thought. And then let's go and talk a little bit about their development. What was Hitler's impression of all of these weapons that were in front of him?
Well, to develop jet engines, of course, you had to have the scientists and the technology and the will and the interest to do it, and it took a long time for that to materialize. The British had an opportunity with Sir Frank Whittle as early as perhaps 1930, when they could have developed a jet engine, but they did so only much later. The American Lockheed engineer Kelly Johnson had a jet aircraft on the drawing boards in 1939, but the will wasn't there, so took a combination of scientific advances and will and willingness to spend money and resources to develop jet engines. And by the time Hitler examined new jets at the weapons display at Insterburg, first of all, I should say that he was pretty familiar with military equipment himself. He had been briefed on all of these items of equipment. He was less impressed by some of what he saw than by other parts of what he saw. He took a look at a six-engine Junkers propeller-driven transport, the Ju-390, and he recognized that it wasn't a very practical design. And that was also recognized by Hitler's personal pilot, Hans Bauer, who was at this event and who was perhaps the closest thing that Adolf Hitler had to an actual friend, if that's possible. So some of the aircraft that were on display got relatively little interest from the Führer, and others got quite a lot. And when it came time to look at the Messerschmitt 262, which is really the focus of my book, Fighting Hitler's Jets by Robert F. Dorr, by the time he looked at that, he was really interested in it, and he was looking at it along with Willy Messerschmitt, who was the owner of the aircraft company that built the aircraft, although Messerschmitt himself had nothing to do with designing it, and in fact was not terribly well informed about it. And in a casual offhand comment, one of those kinds of offhand comments that can sometimes change history, Hitler looked at the 262 and he looked at Messerschmitt and he said, "Tell me, can this thing carry bombs?" And Willy Messerschmitt said
he was an offensively minded individual who was looking for ways to go and get back on the offense in Eastern Europe and, of course, to defend against the coming invasion in Europe.
He knew that the Western Allies were going to make a landing in occupied Europe and that was their plan, and that if he had a fighter-bomber that could drop bombs on them, he thought, that would make it impossible for the invasion to succeed. And Messerschmitt, being ever too eager to please, as were so many people when they were in Hitler's presence, even some very bright and very sensible people seemed to have lost their brilliance and their common sense when they were in his presence. Messerschmitt said, "Well, of course, mein Führer, indeed it can carry bombs. It can carry four 250-kilogram bombs or two 500-kilogram bombs." And, in fact, Willy Messerschmitt, when he was saying that, had no idea what he was talking about, and nobody who was around him could figure out how they were going to make that happen. But that became something of great interest to Hitler, and it ultimately caused delays in the development of this first operational German jet fighter.
And let's go back a little bit, because, as you say, Hitler had a habit of making decisions across the spectrum, and we see examples of it. The Sturmgewehr 44 assault rifle, which was produced over and above his objections. The upgrading of certain models of tanks with different guns than he directed. But jet development had happened pretty much kind of in the background in the late 1930s, correct?
Yes, that's true. Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
the thing was is that if you go to 1939, just as war is about to break out, the three nations that are actually the furthest ahead in jet development are, ironically, Great Britain, Italy, and Germany. Go ahead and talk a little bit about the German early developments, if you will.
Well, the Germans flew the aircraft that is recognized as the first jet aircraft ever to fly. That's the Henkel 178, a fairly simple test bed that simply was a proof of concept vehicle, and it essentially proved that it could fly, and it was the first jet aircraft. The Italians developed aircraft that didn't have propellers but used ducted fan engines. They are today not generally considered to be jets. The British finally did start listening to Frank Whittle and did develop jet engines, and they flew an early jet aircraft in about 1941, or about 2 years after the Germans did. And in the United States, the Bell Aircraft Company was developing the XP-59A Era Comet jet fighter, which flew in 1942. And in fact, when it made its first flight, it was not a very well performing aircraft, but it was fully outfitted and armed and ready to be used as a fighter. That was not yet the case at that point in history with either Germany's Messerschmitt 262 or Britain's Gloster Meteor, both of which were already flying but were not yet configured for combat. So I make the argument in the book, again, the title is Fighting Hitler's Jets, I make the argument that the XP-59A was the first operational jet fighter. Of course, the Messerschmitt 262 eventually did reach squadrons and was fully armed and ready for use and was used in combat. And no American jet was used in combat during the war.
Now, what is the path between the Germans flying the HE-178 in 1939 and the idea of building an operational jet fighter for the Luftwaffe? Who got picked by the Luftwaffe to go ahead and develop these airplanes?
Well, Henkel, whose name was associated with that very first jet and also associated with a twin-engine jet aircraft called the Henkel 280, was in disfavor in the Nazi leadership for various reasons. And Willy Messerschmitt was not. So Messerschmitt got the money and the resources and the encouragement and the development from the Air Ministry and from Hermann Göring, head of the Luftwaffe, and Erich Milch, the leader of the procurement, and Messerschmitt's company got the resources to move ahead with the Messerschmitt 262, and the Henkel designs kind of got left behind in the dust.
Now, there was, in fact...
By the way, I do want to mention that as an author, I spend a lot of time sitting at my desk banging on this keyboard, and I would love to hear from anyone who shares my interest in this subject. So if anybody wants to give me a call here in the 703 area code, I would love to hear from them.
And if anybody wants to talk to us today here on the show, please feel free to call in. Our call-in number is area code 347-945-7246. Again, the call-in line number is area code 347-945-7246. Now, talk a little bit about jet engine development in the Third Reich. What companies actually developed the jet engines, and what kind of engines were they in terms that people would understand today?
The Junkers Company, or looks like Junkers when spelled in English, was the primary developer of jet engines, along with BMW, and they were early simple turbojet designs. They suffered from all kinds of reliability problems. The delays in getting the Messerschmitt 262 into combat were caused in part by the fact that the early jet engines simply were not reliable, and they kept having to make minor improvements to them to make them work better. Again, they were basically simple turbojet engines, and in some ways not too different from what was used in the post-war era. We went all the way well into the 1950s before we started having jet engines that were really sufficiently reliable and provided enough power for what they were expected to do. So those companies throughout German role in World War II struggled with technical challenges, and those challenges were transmitted to the airplane itself. And so the airplane faced technical challenges and was not always as reliable as it should have been.
Now, one of the things that we know today is that their metallurgy really wasn't ready for the jet age. In other words, they simply did not have the high-temperature alloys necessary to go ahead and build turbine blades that would stand up to the heat and wear and tear of sustained jet operations, correct?
That's true, John, yes.
And how about the fuel? What problems or advantages were there to having jet fuel as opposed to high-octane aviation fuel?
Well, you have to keep in mind that you are talking to an Air Force veteran who once sat in the conversation where they talk about what you're going to do in your duties in the military, and got told that he has no mechanical aptitude. So I was very well placed to write a book for general audiences that is not technical in nature, to describe what happened with the German jets and with the Americans who were fighting them, because I don't have enough technical aptitude to describe these things in great mechanical detail. So I'm sort of flubbing your question a little bit, but I was more interested in the personalities of the people that I encountered. Hitler, Goering, Milch on the German side, and of course I talked to American fighter pilots who fought the German jets. That's the major part of the story. And
talk a little bit about some of the personalities. Did you have a chance to either talk to or find accounts of some of the people who were actually involved in the design and construction and testing of these aircraft, particularly the 262?
I found lots of records and documents. I didn't find anyone involved in the development who was available to talk at this point in time. I don't think there's anyone like that left. I did find a couple of German veterans who flew the 262 during World War II and describe their experiences.
Of the accounts you ran into during your research, what did you hear from the various designers of different jet and rocket airplanes? What were the challenges they faced that they openly talked about in these accounts?
The primary issue, of course, was just the general problem of trying to develop a jet engine that was reliable enough to be used operationally. The Messerschmitt 262 had a slight sweep to its wings. The leading edge of the wings is slightly swept. That required some aerodynamic work, but it paved the way for a whole post-war generation of aircraft with swept wings. The American designers of the F-86 Sabre studied the aerodynamics of the ME-262 wing because it offered less resistance and more opportunity for higher speed than you could get out of a typical wing on a propeller-driven airplane.
And we'll talk a little more about some of the other designs that were influenced later on. In addition to the ME-262, there were also several other designs which came along and actually made it into service before the end of the war in 1945. Let's talk a little bit about certainly the most spectacular of those, which was a rocket airplane, again from the Messerschmitt people. In this case, a little rocket airplane called the ME-163 Comet. Talk a little bit about that and the folks who went and put that idea together.
Well, at the weapons display that we discussed at the beginning of the program, where we talked about Hitler looking at a display of new aircraft, Hermann Göring, who was nominally the head of the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, but who was not as well informed as he should have been, walked up to a young-looking guy who was standing in front of this Messerschmitt 163 Comet, and the Comet looks a little bit like an arrowhead with an exhaust. Very small aircraft, but very impressive. And the fellow standing in front of it was very young and very small. His name was Rudy Opitz. And Göring looked at him and said, "Are you the mechanic for this, or are you the guy who washes it, or what?" And Rudy Opitz said, "I am in charge of this program, sir." And he was the pilot who did the early test flying in the 163, trying to achieve some reliability with the rocket motor on the Messerschmitt 163 and trying to transform it into an operational aircraft. It did indeed fly combat missions. There were one or two Allied pilots who were credited with shooting them down. But the problem was that with the rocket motor, it had a very short duration, and there was really no way to redesign it to extend that. So it could basically go up and fly around and fight for a few minutes, and then it would have to land. And to save weight...
And then, of course, there was the problem that the darn thing, the rocket motor itself, used a hypergolic or self-igniting combination of chemicals that was pretty nasty, correct?
Oh, yes, and dangerous to use, and toxic, all those things. Yes, indeed.
I mean, the flight crews, when they went up in it, because of the propensity of leaks and the problem with gaskets and such, they had to wear rubber hazmat suits underneath their flying suits for fear that it would go and eat their skin, correct?
Yes.
And, of course, like many of the designs of the day, because the engines were so lacking in power, this thing did not have a conventional landing gear. It landed on a skid.
Yes, I was just getting ready to say that. That was to save weight because it had relatively limited duration available that it could fly. And it worked reasonably well most of the time.
Now,
I think we should remind our listeners what we're talking about here. We're talking about a book called Fighting Hitler's Jets. It was written by me. I'm Bob Dorr, Robert F. Dorr. And I would love to hear from anybody that would like to talk about it.
And just back to the 163 and its rather hazardous qualities. It was a little bug-like thing, very dangerous to fly, very dangerous to take off and land in, but had amazing performance. I mean, it was, at that time, the fastest manned airplane in the world, correct?
I think it was, yes. That sounds right, John.
And this
wasn't
airplane...
It wasn't the only aircraft that was wobbly, but it certainly was unstable and difficult to fly.
All right. We're going to talk a little more about flying these weapons here in a couple of minutes. First, we're going to have a couple of network messages, and we'll be back to talk more about fighting Hitler's jets with Bob Dorr in a couple of minutes.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Rightstream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for Rightstream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. Rightstream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. Rightstream Tuesday with Daria Ann. Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Rightstream Radio Network.
Hi, this is Lisa Tarvis. I'm a metaphysician, board-certified holistic health practitioner, energy healer, intuitive, and the author of the book, Just Believe. I'm also a host on the Rightstream Network. My radio show is called Just Believe and airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please stop by my website at www.lisatarvis.com. That's LISATARVES. For details on all the services I offer, information on my book, and my radio show. There are many amazing guests and fascinating topics scheduled for the show in the upcoming months. I look forward to connecting with you soon.
You're listening to the Rightstream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Rightstream and hashtag Rightstream. Thanks for listening to the Rightstream Radio Network.
And we are back with Bob Dorr talking about his new book, Fighting Hitler's Jets, which has just come out. And we're going to go and talk for a few minutes about what they were like to fly and fight with. Bob, you obviously managed to find some accounts and talk to a few people who had fought with them. I personally knew, for example, slightly from his visits here in the States, General Adolf Galland, DOFO to those of us who knew him, who was part of an amazing unit of ME-262 pilots, JG-44, towards the end of the war. Talk a little bit about the people who flew these aircraft and what kinds of missions they flew.
Galland, fairly early on, as one of the most capable fighter pilots and leaders in the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, recommended that the Germans stop producing all aircraft types except the Focke-Wulf 190 propeller-driven fighter and the Messerschmitt 262, the jet. Galland felt that if they took all the resources that were being used on the rather dated Messerschmitt BF-109 and on some of the experimental programs that weren't producing much result, that if they put all those resources into two types of fighters, that they would have a much more formidable air force to oppose the bombing campaign being launched from the west by the Western Allies. And they didn't listen to Galland on that, but Galland did lead some of the early jet pilots, and he did pioneer some of the tactics and techniques that they used to engage the Allied bomber formations flying over Nazi Germany. On the other side, you had the P-51 Mustang, propeller-driven fighter that was somewhat reluctantly introduced into the U.S. Army Air Forces in late 1943. Not as fast as the Messerschmitt 262, but flown by very well-trained pilots. And as the war progressed, the training and quality of the American pilots improved, and the availability of well-trained, experienced, mature pilots on the German side declined. And we reached a point where the propeller-driven P-51 Mustangs on the American side were able to range out from the bomber formations and search out German airfields and search out opportunities to engage the German jets when they were in the takeoff and landing patterns at their airfields, or when they were on the ground, when they were completely vulnerable and their technological advantages didn't help them. We also had, 165 American fighter pilots who were credited with shooting down German jets in air-to-air combat, flying all of the major types of fighters that were in use on our side during the war. Very often it was partly a matter of luck, partly a matter of skill, partly failure of some reliability function in the Messerschmitt 262, but whatever the reason, you have guys like my friend Huey Lam, who lives in Austin, Texas today, and you can even find him on Facebook. He's a very high-tech guy at age 92. He was flying a P-47 Thunderbolt, and he engaged a Messerschmitt 262 and shot it down. It was a fairly consistent demonstration of the fact that all of the pilots on one side were well-trained and capable, and only some of the pilots on the other side were. That's what enabled prop-driven Allied fighter planes to defeat German jets.
And the fact that German jets, as you say, had to come into land somewhere after they flew around, and P-51...
Catch them when they're low on fuel, catch them when they have the landing gear and the flaps down, catch them when they're moving at slow speed, and they suddenly become a tempting target.
So when they were low and slow, they were as vulnerable as any other fixed-wing aircraft coming into land.
Perhaps even more so, John, yes.
When Absolutely. You say perhaps even more so, why is that?
Well, Messerschmitt 262 was, first of all, a relatively large airplane, so it had a large visual signature. It needed a fairly long approach, and there was quite a long period of time when it was vulnerable to attack.
Bob, we just had a question typed into me here from our good friend Mike Markowitz, who asks the question. I understand your interest in Nazi technology, but in reality, didn't Germany's obsession with wonder weapons actually hasten Germany's defeat by wasting scarce resources on dream projects? Let's take just a minute and answer that question. These were obviously very advanced weapon systems for the day, well ahead of their time, but did they not go and suck up huge amounts of talent and resources to bring them into service?
They did indeed, and Mike Markowitz makes an excellent point, and that harkens back to the recommendation that fighter pilot Adolf Galland made. He wanted to produce just one type of jet fighter. He wanted to manufacture in large numbers the one jet fighter that appeared to have great promise to succeed in combat. And he wanted to take all of the money that was being spent on some of the useless projects that the Germans were working on. In the book Fighting Hitler's Jets, you will also read about the Henkel 162 and the Bochum Natter and half a dozen other projects that never produced a single successful combat sortie, all of which could have easily been set aside. The Germans could have focused on just the one type of jet, or had they chosen, they could have focused only on propeller-driven aircraft. The way that we defeated them in the West on the Western Front was not with technology, but with sheer numbers. It was with the products of the vast industrial base in the American heartland that produced almost 100,000 airplanes in calendar year 1944 alone. It was sheer numbers, and the German approach was to waste a lot of resources on scientific and technological projects. It ended up producing nothing. Some of them really quite absurd. There is some evidence to believe that the Germans really were trying to build a time machine.
Really?
You'll have to read the book Fighting Hitler's Jets by Robert F. Dorr if you want to know about that. But it is true indeed that this advanced technology wasted a lot of resources that could have been used to produce more traditional weapons in greater numbers, perhaps requiring somewhat less skill to use, which was a problem on the German side. So I think Mike is exactly right in raising that point.
Now, while Galland wanted to go ahead and limit jet production to just one fighter airplane, there was, in fact, a relatively successful bomber and reconnaissance aircraft put out that actually did some good work along with the 262, known as the Arado 234 Blitz, or Lightning, a very popular name for our fighter airplane over the years. Talk just a little bit about this aircraft and its unique features.
That is indeed true. The Arado 234 has a modernistic look. It has a completely rounded nose without any significant bumps or bulges. It was a twin-engine bomber. It used some of the same technology as the Messerschmitt 262, slightly larger, a bomber and reconnaissance aircraft, and served very effectively on reconnaissance missions. Our side started to see them in large numbers around the time that we were seizing the bridge at Remagen and getting ready to cross the Rhine. And some of the air-to-air engagements that I write about in the book Fighting Hitler's Jets take place against the Arado 234 with the Remagen Bridge in the background.
Amazing.
By the way, it was not easy to get into. It was very hard to climb into the Arado 234. You had to use steps that were built into the side of the fuselage and get up on top of the fuselage and then climb down into the cockpit from above.
And to go ahead and do a reconnaissance or bombing run, you had to literally change positions from your normal seating to a prone position. So looking out the bubble nose, correct?
I do not remember that learning that to be the case, John, but it may well be.
I was given a tour of the Air and Space Museum, Zorado, and it was amazing. I obviously do not fit. I'm a large man like yourself, so I couldn't even get into it. But I remember them having one of the smaller female curators who was part of the restoration team wiggle around in it and show the contortions that you had to go ahead and do to get into the aircraft. And at the same time, the Arado 234 was, correct me if I'm wrong, a beneficiary of rocket technology in that it used rocket-assisted takeoff units frequently to help it get off the ground with heavy payloads, correct?
Yes, it did. And the only surviving example of the Arado 234 is the one you looked at. It's at the Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy Center of the National Air and Space Museum at Dulles Airport in Washington, D.C. It's the only one left. And it is quite a remarkable sight.
And it has the German RATO units on it, and looks like you could taxi it out and take it for a run if you wanted to. In terms of operational usage and tactics, what were the primary advantages of the German jets and rocket aircraft over their Allied counterparts if they were coming up, for example, to intercept a bomber stream or do a reconnaissance mission?
If you were the pilot of a Messerschmitt 262 and everything was working right, you had the best air-to-air fighting platform that anybody had ever built. It was, when it was working right, it was fast, it was maneuverable, it was heavily armed, it was reliable. You could take off, and once you've tucked in the landing gear and climbed up to fighting altitude and get ready to engage those American B-17s over Stuttgart, you had an aircraft that was fast and maneuverable and really could not be touched by anybody else.
It literally had a 100-mile-an-hour speed advantage over a Mustang, which was very
quick. It did.
And correct me if I'm wrong, it also had an advantage in that while the American airplanes had 6 or 8 very fine 50-caliber machine guns, these airplanes, the 262 in particular, was carrying 4 30-millimeter cannons spitting out high-explosive rounds.
Yes, that's true, and there are arguments for both kinds of armament, but certainly when you are using the cannon, if you score hits, they're going to be lethal hits. And if you are a German fighter pilot and you're engaging an American bomber on a head-on pass 5 degrees above the center line in the position the Americans call 12 o'clock high, if you can put a couple of cannon rounds into the flight deck of that B-17, you're going to kill the pilots, and that bomber is going to go down. And the German jet fighter pilots did this repeatedly. If they had been able to do it earlier in the war, the whole history of the war might have been very different.
Now, in theory, if Hitler had not gone and mandated that a substantial percentage of the 262 production go to the fighter-bomber version, could the Germans have gone into 44 with their first jet fighter units in time to intercept the 8th Air Force when they began the 44 bombing campaign we called Big Week?
Well, I think it would be more appropriate to ask if the aircraft developer Ernst Henkel had not been in disfavor, and if the Germans had gone ahead with the Henkel 280 twin-engine jet fighter, which predated the Messerschmitt 262, it was similar to it in many respects, it's pretty much a sure thing that if they had done that, they would have had a squadron of jet fighters available much earlier than, in fact, they did. And as you know, prior to Big Week in February of 1944, we had not yet perfected the technique of using escort fighters that were able to escort bombers all the way to their targets. and we had disasters like the second Schweinfurt raid where 60 B-17s were shot down in one day, each with 10 men on board. And if jet fighters had been available that early, they would have halted the Allied bombing campaign. And if the Allied bombing campaign had been halted, it probably would have been necessary to postpone the invasion of Europe.
Let's talk about what it was like for the Allied air crews as they began to see these new super weapons emerge. We obviously have accounts as early as late 1943 of what were probably ME-262s and other test airplanes flying test flights, maybe going up and sniffing at bomber formations, but not really getting involved. What was the first real occasion where German jets or rocket airplanes started getting into Allied formations and actually mixing it up with Allied fighters and bombers?
Well, one thing that I find interesting is that the Allied pilots, the American pilots, were much better informed about the German aircraft than you might think. They had recognition models and drawings and diagrams long before they actually ran into them. So when I talked, for example, to an American P-51 Mustang ace named Don Bryan, Don studied what his intelligence officer had to offer on the German aircraft before he ever saw one. He saw the Arado 234 in the air once or twice before he actually engaged one, and then he engaged one unsuccessfully before he finally was on a mission in which he shot one down. And similar situation with the air action involving the Messerschmitt 262. The American pilots were not in any way cowed or frightened by the German technology. They were very level-headed and sensible about searching for ways that they could seek advantage when they had an opportunity in combat, and they had a fairly high level of confidence in themselves and in their equipment.
And as you pointed out, there was a numeric advantage almost universally between Allied fighters versus the German ones. As Mike Markowitz pointed out in another note, there were only 1,433 ME-262 jets produced and only 370 ME-163s compared to over 10,000 P-38s and 15,000 each of the P-51 and the P-47. There is something to be said for, as Lenin said, quantity has a quality all its own, and this was certainly one of those occasions, correct?
Even those numbers might be misleading, because the actual number of Messerschmitt 262s that were capable of participating in combat at any one time was never more than 200 to 300 at most.
And
so, yes, it is indeed correct that the Allies literally overwhelmed the Germans with numbers.
And there were just rare occasions where large numbers of 262s would go and engage. I remember one of the better known, of course, involved the famous test airmen, the Red Tails, flying out of the 15th Air Force on a Berlin mission, where they apparently had a substantial number of 262s dogfighting inside their formations, correct?
Another of the fantastic people that I got to talk with when writing this book. The book is Fighting Hitler's Jets, and I got to talk with Roscoe Brown, who is a Tuskegee Airman who shot down a Messerschmitt 262 high over Berlin on the first occasion when the 15th Air Force in Italy and the Tuskegee Airmen reached Berlin. And they never were in any way intimidated by the German jets. They felt that with their training and their skill that even though the German jets were faster and more heavily armed, that they could find ways to defeat them, and by golly, they did.
We get to the end of World War II, and the jets go from being a source of fear and wonder to one of the hottest tickets in captured technology. I knew a number of OSS personnel who, in addition to going after German rockets and nuclear scientists, also were ordered to go and grab any examples they could of advanced German aircraft technology, especially jets, jet engines, and the personnel who designed them. Talk a little bit about the post-war world for
The Army Air Forces had a group of specialists called Watson's Wizards, and they were led by Colonel Harold Watson, a very experienced pilot and engineer. And they went around Germany immediately after the end of fighting in Europe and rounded up examples of pretty much everything they could find. I mean, Watson and his assistant McIntosh actually flew a four-engine Junkers 290 transport all the way from Germany to Wright Field in Ohio. And that airplane was displayed at air shows a couple of times, and then very sadly it was scrapped, and there's no example of it left in the world today. Watson himself flew the Messerschmitt 262 both in Germany and also at Wright Field, Ohio, and at Freeman Field in Indiana. And I guess that's a good way to lead into the air show that provides the other sort of end of the story of fighting Hitler's jets. On October 13th of 1945 at Wright Field, Ohio, they held what was called the Army Air Forces Fair, F-A-I-R. It was an air show. It was open to the public. And all of the captured German equipment was all on display at that show. One of the Germans who had been recruited by the Americans and helped the Americans during the post-war effort was a 262 test pilot named Carl Bauer. He is the only man to have been at both of the air shows that we're talking about, the one that was held for Hitler in Insterburg in 1944 and the one that was held in Wright Field in Ohio after the war.
Indeed. And what was the public reaction to these airplanes when they saw them going across the sky and they didn't hear prop noise or piston engines?
I've talked to people who were there, and they basically ignored some of the new American equipment that was on display at the same show, including the P-80, the first version of what became the F-80 Shooting Star of the Korean War. They pretty much ignored the P-80 and ran to look at the German aircraft because they'd never seen anything like it before. And the German aircraft were displayed in something representing their original markings, including the swastika, and they drew crowds.
Impressive.
And Watson put on a flying display in the 262, and everybody turned up to look at what he was doing.
To close out the story of these aircraft, let's talk a little bit more about the influence that they had on post-war jet and rocket aircraft development. not just here in the United States, Great Britain, France, Russia. Talk a little bit about that, and how important was the German effort in providing the, if you will, bridge to the future for aircraft designers?
Well, the Americans and the Soviets both recruited their own groups of German scientists and captured and absorbed vast quantities of German engineering data. I mentioned earlier the design of the airplane that became the F-86 Sabre. It was originally designed as a straight-wing airplane. Larry Green, who was on the engineering team at North American, went to night school to study the German language in order to read documents about the Messerschmitt 262 that related to the sweep on the leading edge of the wing. At the same time, the Soviets were looking over German data on swept wings and jet engines and other advanced technology, and they were developing the airplane that became the MiG-15, which is very strongly influenced in particular by the work of an engineer named Kurt Tunk, who was associated with Focke Wulf. So, and of course, the British had their own exploitation of German technology, and so the technology that went into the German jets was a huge influence in the post-war era in all of the major countries that developed aircraft.
And with that, we'll close this out and ask you, what's next for you, Bob? You're a prolific author. You have far, I feel puny next to you sometimes with my mere 15 books compared to your total. What you working on next?
I'm working very slowly and very carefully on a history of a U.S. Navy dive bomber squadron in the Pacific in World War II. And I'm going to do it on my schedule, so don't look for it anytime soon. But I do have copies of Fighting Hitler's Jets available here if anybody wants to contact me and get one.
Very good. Bob, I want to thank you not just for coming on today, but in the past, and I want to thank you for helping us build this show. Have a happy holiday. We'll be talking soon. And take care, my friend.
Happy to be on Military Monday. Thank you so much, John, and you take care as well.
And with that, we close out this Christmas Eve show. Just two things I want to talk about. First, we will be doing a show next Monday, and it will be another hopefully fun show on another subject that historians love, especially American historians, that being the Battle of Gettysburg. We are going to have the sort of reigning king of Gettysburg books, David Petruzzi, coming on to talk about a couple of his books and what is now happening up at the battlefield and its surrounding complex of displays and parklands now that the big 150th anniversary is completed. Just because we've hit the 150-year mark there doesn't mean that it isn't going to stay the busiest of the battlefield national parks in America. I'd also like to go and, with some sadness, announce the passing of a true icon in the military world. We got word this morning out of Russia that General Mikhail Kalashnikov, who was in his 90s, passed away. Mikhail Kalashnikov, and the name undoubtedly is familiar to you, was the designer and developer of the famous AK-47 assault rifle, the most prolific and most mass-produced firearm of all time. Literally, tens of millions of these weapons have been produced across the globe and have become an iconic symbol, so much so it's even been on a national flag or two to commemorate its importance in the revolutionary beginnings of those countries. Mikhail Kalashnikov was not what you would call an educated man. He was a tank sergeant who was wounded during the Great Patriotic War in World War II, and during his recovery, began to tinker with the idea of an automatic rifle. And by 1947, that automatic rifle was ready for production and became the AK-47. Whether you are a fan of the weapon or firearms in general, Mikhail Kalashnikov was one of the greatest inventors of the 20th century and of our time. And for those of us who had the pleasure to meet the general, shake his hand, and listen to a little of his sage wisdom about firearms and life, we're going to miss him. With that, I go and say, let us go and close out this edition of Military Monday. I hope you have a Merry Christmas, and we will talk to you next Monday when we talk about Gettysburg.
I took a flat to a pawn shop for a broken guitar. I took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? I took a flat to a pawn shop. Got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? Saw a man on the TV in a mask with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw a man on the TV, his son had a gun. And he said that he's coming for me. I never loved a soldier until there was a war. I thought about tomorrow till my baby hits the floor. I only talk to God when somebody's about to die. I never cherished freedom. Freedom never cried. May he forget why he's crying. crying so dear.